Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hey, this is Henry Melcher. I'm a supervising producer at Late Night.
And this is Sal Gentile. I'm a supervising writer, and I write A Closer Look.
Welcome to our Year in Review Late Night Cram episode. We're going to look back on the year that was 2019. So last night, before we started recording, Sal, I listened to our 2018 Year in Review, and we spent the first 9 minutes talking about John Kelly, a figure who seems almost lost to time at this point.
Completely absent. You'd have to dig up the fossil record to find out. You'd have to look at carbon date when John Kelly was. You'd have to cut open a tree and see the rings inside to find out what era was John Kelly in.
There was article after article about John Kelly's imminent departure from the White House as chief of staff. At that point, he had not even left yet.
When you listened to that podcast, how much were you surprised by besides the John Kelly? Like, how much of it were you like, oh yeah, that's also a thing that happened?
Well, John Kelly was surprising to hear how much time we spent on him. But, you know, we talked about this idea that so much in politics changed in 2018. We had the historic midterm wins, the historic freshman class of Democrats. But at the same time, everything kind of felt very stuck and very the same. There was Trump scandal after Trump scandal. Yeah. And it felt like every day we were just kind of trudging through the same type of Trump news and nothing seemed to actually be breaking through. We're kind of stuck in these very polarized camps. And it seems like 2019 in many ways feels very similar.
So we're going to take you through a little tour of our year this year through the interviews that you've produced, Henry, and through the closer looks that we've done. And so something I wanted to start with, this was all the way back in January.
Mm-hmm. 12 years ago in January.
Yeah, this was a couple decades ago in January of 2019. This is how we began the year because, again, it's probably difficult to remember, but we were awaiting the Mueller report at that time. And that was the most highly anticipated thing. So this was all the way at the beginning of the year, we were awaiting the Mueller report, and we did something we like to do occasionally, where we just laid out a summation of the evidence against Donald Trump. This was at the beginning of the year, and it might sound somewhat familiar to you. This is how we began the year.
While the FBI was investigating whether Trump was working for the Russians. I mean, what tipped them off? Was it Trump's secret meeting with the Russians at the Oval Office? His son's secret meeting with Russians at Trump Tower? His lawyer's secret deal to build a Trump Tower in Moscow? Jeff Sessions' secret meeting with the Russian ambassador? Jared Kushner's secret back channel with the Kremlin? Michael Flynn's secret back channel with the Kremlin? Eric Prince's secret back channel with the Kremlin? Paul Manafort sharing secret polling data with the Russians? His foreign policy advisor's secret meeting with the Russians? The Russian hackers who helped Trump win? Trump asking the Russian hackers to help him win? Or Vladimir Putin smile every time he sees Trump? Look at that. That's the smile Putin gives when someone says, "We have captured James Bond."
First of all, to hear how many names in that list have been, again, totally forgotten to time.
Oh, completely.
Like, remember Eric Prince's secret meeting in the Seychelles with a Kremlin agent?
I remember the week of the Seychelles because we were all Googling where the Seychelles
are.
Where are
the Seychelles? Yeah.
Seychelles are beautiful. It looks like where Bond would do.
Exactly.
Or a Bond villain would.
It is a classic Exactly. It's like what classic exotic location where Bond would have some
prop plane.
Incidental like, car chase. Yes, prop plane landing on
or
the ocean.
Or a seaplane land.
Yeah,
some sort of briefcase is exchanged. But this is the very strange cinematic world of the Trump administration where this stuff is just happening day after day after day.
Yes.
And what's interesting is, not to jump too far ahead, but where we are now, we are currently in the process of the beginnings of the impeachment process of Donald Trump. And none of that's included in the impeachment.
None of that. A whole list of Trump's alleged criminality. The Mueller report laid out very clearly, as when we got it a few months later, that not only had Trump obviously obstructed justice and Mueller listed 10 accounts of it, but also that the Russians interfered in the election and that Trump actively welcomed and encouraged it. And none of that is in the articles of impeachment that at this moment may have been voted on. If you're listening to this, we're recording this as they're debating it in the House Judiciary Committee right now. But it's crazy to think that that's how far we've come.
Yeah.
This happens with Trump with a lot of what he does because he's committed so many impeachable offenses.
Pick what you like.
Exactly.
So the next month, we had another character that is now, I believe, in prison, Michael Cohen. So he testified, and this was a blockbuster TV event.
Yes.
There was the countdown to the Michael Cohen testimony.
Which we pointed out in a closer look at that time, I remember. Fox News complained that there were countdown clocks on the other networks, and then, or Fox and Friends did. And then after Fox and Friends was over, their news programming took over, and they put up a countdown clock to the Michael Cohen testimony.
Perfect.
Yes, perfect.
That is such a perfect distillation. So Michael Cohen, this is a closer look you wrote in February.
Yes.
About the Michael Cohen testimony.
Yes.
Let's listen to that.
Donald Trump is a man who ran for office to make his brand great, not to make our country great. He had no desire or intention to lead this nation, only to market himself and to build his wealth and power. Mr. Trump would often say, this campaign was going to be the greatest infomercial in political history.
It's true. And like any product you buy from an infomercial, it turned out to be much crappier than it looked on TV. Trump, if we're being honest, Donald Trump is the Slanket of presidents. On TV, you thought, that's cool, a blanket with sleeves. And now 2 years later, it's stained, shrinking, and filled with farts. And you're like, get this thing out of my house.
This was the day that we all kind of rooted for Michael Cohen.
Yeah, so this was a guy who had literally said on the record many times, or he had told friends in articles, sources said, you know, Michael would take a bullet for Donald. Like, he'd do anything for him. Like, he'd been on TV forever defending whatever and anything Donald Trump had said, going back to before he was a presidential candidate, when, you know, going back to previous elections when he was thinking about running for president, when he was spreading the birther lie, like all of those things. And then he came to this hearing and he presented all of this evidence of Trump's criminality. He presented, and then again, we just talked about things that are not in the articles of impeachment. Donald Trump is named in a court document as an individual one who Michael Cohen identified in this hearing as Donald Trump, who directed an illegal scheme to hide hush money that he had paid to cover an affair. And Michael Cohen presented the checks that Donald Trump had signed, and we saw Donald Trump's signature on them.
And yet, and not a high crime, not a misdemeanor.
Not in the articles of impeachment. And that is another thing that happened. Also, we should say there was another shocking moment where a member of Congress asked Cohen, do you have any knowledge of other crimes that we haven't discussed today? And he just said, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, of course.
Yes, of course he does. But I picked that specific section of Closer because it was in many ways a thesis statement for both Cohen's testimony and for Trump's presidency overall, which is, of course, that he only sees everything through the lens of how it benefits him personally. But the presidency and all elected office of any kind at any level is a public trust. Mm-hmm. And as we're seeing right now with the Ukraine scandal, with the impeachment process, and we saw with Cohen and in that specific clip, Trump began his campaign and from the beginning of his campaign all the way through today has only acted in one way, and that is whatever would benefit or enrich himself personally. And he's willing to cheat or do whatever he has to do that.
Totally. That was a point that Bernie Sanders made on our show very recently after the Michael Cohen hearing. He was on our show in February, and Seth asked Bernie if he'd caught any of the Michael Cohen hearing.
Did you have time to watch the Michael Cohen hearing yesterday? And what was your takeaway?
I watched it a bit. And my takeaway is that Cohen kind of confirmed what many of us had known. And by the way, it really does not give me pleasure to say that what we have always known is that we have a president who is a pathological liar. We have a president who, as Cohen indicated, is a racist. And we have a president who is a fraud. He is a fraud.
I think Bernie sums it up pretty
well. Yeah, he really does.
Well.
And also, you know, it's remarkable to have, think of all of the sworn testimony we've had from aides close to Trump who have personally witnessed things firsthand, his closest advisors, Michael Cohen among them, the impeachment process, people who had firsthand knowledge of the Ukraine quid pro quo, saying that there was a quid pro quo in all of these cases. And on top of detailing his serial corruption and criminality, you also have Michael Cohen on the record in sworn testimony saying the current sitting president of the United States is obviously, as a person who has known him for a long time, is obviously and has always been a virulent racist, yeah. as Bernie pointed out. Michael Cohen said that in his testimony. That is in the congressional record. That's a historic thing that, you know, it's both something that's obviously true to everybody who has been observing
this
president since the very moment he announced his candidacy, since the very first speech, before that, since the racist birther lie. And yet you have somebody who's been incredibly close to him for years going before Congress and entering into the official record. This man is a virulent, pathological liar, a racist, and a fraud.
So that was Bernie on our show in February. That was very shortly after he announced his candidacy. Oh, another thing I wanted to mention from the last year in review, I had just seen a poll before we started recording in 2018 that Beto was possibly the leading candidate in the Democratic field. If you're not paying attention, Beto O'Rourke is no longer running for president. Kamala Harris, who is someone that we all thought would be a top contender, is also not running. But something we did this summer was do live shows of the Democratic debates. We were live after the first Democratic debate. This was very exciting, and there was an amazing moment at the top of the debate that got a lot of people's attention.
Yeah.
Beto O'Rourke started speaking Spanish, and the camera caught Cory Booker with the most severe side eye and kind of surprise I've ever seen in my life.
Yes.
And that there was a lot of policy discussed in the first debate, and that was kind of the takeaway.
Yes. It was refreshing when the Democratic debate started because then you got to see a group of sane people, smart, accomplished people on stage talking about policy.
Discussing financing mechanisms for a Medicare for All system.
Talking about how to provide health care to as many people as possible. It was refreshing. And yet, you're right, a main takeaway was this amazing moment. I was sequestered in a little room during these live shows where I had a little drip, like a gerbil,
water.
And then I was just typing as fast as I could. And when this moment happened, we knew we had to talk about it. So first, we'll play a clip from our closer look about that moment. And then, after that, we'll get to the interview with Cory Booker, where Seth asked him about that face.
Yeah.
So first, here's a closer look.
That's the face you make when you see someone trying to cram a suitcase that doesn't fit into the overhead. That's the face you make when a guy gets on the subway with a pet snake around his neck. Is anyone else seeing this?
Yeah, so Cory Booker was on our show shortly after that, and we asked about that moment, and we wanted him to just kind of explain what was going through his head.
One of the memeable moments from the first night of the debates.
Beto
O'Rourke, he started speaking Spanish, and you were caught on camera.
Yes.
And that looks like...
Yes.
Now, I think the technical term there might be side-eye.
Yes.
Now, I would imagine in the moment, you were probably not aware that this was going to be one of the takeaways of that debate.
The coaching I got from my campaign team, these are really incredible professionals, was don't do that again.
I love that honesty from Cory Booker. So we've had a lot of the candidates on late night this year, and a lot of them speak to how difficult the debates are because there are so many people and you were asked so many things so quickly and you have such a short amount of time to do it.
And there's also this dynamic where the moderators are essentially trying to pit people against each other to get them to fight as much as possible, or at least in the early debates. All debates are different. It's difficult probably to orchestrate these debates as a moderator, but nonetheless, there is this weird dynamic where, for example, they would use like a John Delaney or a Tim Ryan as a foil. Yeah, there was a debate.
Because Biden was in the next debate. So it was the day that John Delaney... He became the moderator in the race, and everyone was responding to John Delaney. Meanwhile, most people at home are like, who the hell
is John Delaney? He's polling at basically zero, but because he was in the first round of debates, and he was the self-proclaimed moderate who was running against the ambitious proposals of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, the moderators kept asking Elizabeth Warren a question or Bernie Sanders a question, and then saying, Congressman Delaney, how do you respond? And you'd get these split screens of front runners like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders constantly having to respond to this guy at the end of the stage that he looks like he wandered on stage from an insurance commercial.
Or a CrossFit class.
Yeah, or a CrossFit class because he's a jacked guy.
He's jacked.
Yeah.
So let's just do this back to back. Here's Beto O'Rourke and Bernie Sanders talking about the difficulty of the debates.
As you prepare for these debates, especially ones where it'll be you and nine other people on stage, and short answers, is it frustrating to then take that same message that, given the luxury of a little bit more time with people, you feel like gets across versus what you'll be up against next week?
Short answer is yes.
it's
a very different experience to try to package a really complex policy issue and reflect what you've learned from everyone that you've listened to in America into 60 seconds, and then to attempt to do that while nine other people are talking over you simultaneously. And yet, that's what we've got to do. That's where we are right now.
The debate format is just weird. You know, you're asked complicated questions, and then you got 30 seconds to respond. Tell us what you're going to do about the healthcare crisis. All right, time's up.
Hearing Bernie Sanders just call something weird is very funny.
Oh, it's the best.
So then really quickly, and then we could talk about this, here's a closer look from our live show in July on the second round of debates, where we talked a little bit just about the posture of the moderators trying to get the candidates to go up against each other.
CNN was so desperate to get them to fight, they were like Romans at the Colosseum. Healthcare plans, he says yours is foolish, you say his is cruel. Now fight for our pleasure!
I love Seth's Roman Emperor impression.
Very good.
Yeah, great Roman Emperor impression. But yeah, so it was really fascinating to hear Bernie and Beto and the other candidates we've had on the show give firsthand knowledge to what that experience is like, because
it seems
as Bernie said, very weird.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There was this other question that we asked a lot of the politicians that were on our show this year. Another question where we're just looking for this honesty of how strange this moment is. It was a question for the senators. If it's awkward at work right now, because so many of your colleagues are also running for the Democratic nomination, my favorite answer to this question, I mean, back to Bernie. Bernie literally said, yeah, it's weird. I think he said weird again. It's really great. But my favorite reaction to this question was from Michael Bennett, who is still running for president. He's in the 0 to 1% range. But he gave an answer that really was such a delight to hear. You probably didn't expect a Michael Bennett clip on this year in review, not the weekend day, a full year. And we're going to play a little Michael Bennett for you. Here's Michael Bennett talking about how awkward it is at work.
Seven senators running. And I've asked this question to Bernie Sanders, to Kamala Harris. Is it awkward at work when you are talking to someone else who thinks they should be president more than you?
Yeah, it can be awkward, but a lot hasn't changed. We have the same red Jello every day for lunch.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. You know, you think it's not sexy, and
Bernie,
then you hear that, and you're like, "Wow, what a cool job."
I know. Actually, you wonder why, with so many varieties of Jello, we have to have the same one every lunch.
Is that
but
something?
But for 10 years, it's the same stuff.
Is it that the Republicans that choose that it's red Jello? Is that
actually
something?
I don't know that. I don't know the answer.
Yeah,
to that.
We'll get to the bottom of it.
It was so crazy the first time I ever walked into that place. You have to give a speech when you go back there for the first time, and you walk in that room and they're all there. At that time, Hillary Clinton was still there.
Yeah.
And John Kerry was still there, and. But then they're sitting there just eating Jell-O like anybody else who's in kindergarten.
Yeah. The problem with Jell-O as a food, and I don't want to make this all about Jell-O, there's not like a refined way to eat it. You know what I mean? You could only eat it like, it's not like at Downton Abbey, they bring out a knife and fork for the Jell-O.
No, you can't do that.
No, you can't do that.
That's probably enough on the Jell-O.
Yeah, it's probably enough.
That is incredible.
My favorite.
Yeah, absolutely, such a funny answer. And he delivers it so dryly. His delivery of that story is incredible. They're talking about the red jello. Like, it's nice when you get politicians on and they get to show some of their humanity because they have so few opportunities to actually do that. But speaking of the weirdness, we were talking a lot about the firsthand weirdness that a lot of the candidates are experiencing as they go through this process. I want to fast forward to a closer look in September. This is now as investigations are heating up and Trump is using all kinds of really dark language that he had already used, but it was intensifying in a way that he was calling people who were investigating him treasonous. He was calling for Democrats like Adam Schiff to be arrested, using all of this like dark, demagogic, authoritarian language. And there's this weird phenomenon going on where there's incredible grassroots energy in response to this historically dangerous presidency. Yeah. Obviously, we saw that in the 2018 midterms. Since essentially he announced his campaign, the majority of Americans say they dislike Donald Trump. They do not want him to be president. Polls have shown that 50% want him removed from office. Yeah. And yet, in terms of our political system, there's this very weird phenomenon going on where a lot of our political system and the media just essentially have to live with and ignore the fact that the president says insane, deranged things on a regular basis. And this is how we sort of summed it up in a closer look in September.
But this is dangerous. The president is threatening arrest and imprisonment for people who dare to investigate his abuses of power. The only thing stopping our system from collapsing is that everyone just ignores it. We've all gotten to the point where we have to treat the president of the United States like a guy taking a in a subway car. At some point, everyone's just going to move to the other end of the country.
I think this also speaks to this strange moment in terms of how journalists are covering this era. Because at the beginning of the Trump administration, journalists would cover every single tweet that Trump did. And they would say, well, if the president tweets it, it's news. And it may not be good, and it may be inflammatory, and it may be just trying to make news or distract people with these tweets, but it's news. And now you hear from journalists all the time. And they're like, we're not going to cover everything he tweets. It's crazy. And it's making all of us crazy. And it is distraction.
Yeah.
He does it to distract. But at the same time, we've all adapted to the craziness.
The same phenomenon has happened with his rallies. Of course, we all remember famously the media's obsession with his rallies during the campaigns, the famous shots of the empty podium just waiting for him to arrive and then airing his rallies completely unedited from beginning to end. And now, you know, the media has made a concerted effort to basically just ignore the rallies as much as possible unless he makes news at them. And, you know, there is this difficult negotiation where on the one hand, because Trump has said as much, or rather people close to Trump have said, because you were talking about the tweets, he enjoys the fact that he can essentially tweet something and it's like pushing a button and you watch it pop up on TV.
The power is immense.
And so there is a degree to which taking that power away from him is valuable. And so the whole political system has had to figure out, like, how do we deal with this? Like, what do we treat as a genuine threat that we have to respond to? What do we just ignore? Like, it's the ramblings of a crazy, deranged lunatic, which they are. And so there's been that odd phenomenon going on.
Another one of the major changes this year in 2019 was the oversight power that Democrats have. They have power of subpoena. They have the power to bring witnesses before Congress. Many Democrats kind of stood out from their questioning this year. Two that stood out to us and were on our show are Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Katie Porter. And Seth asked both of them how they frame up questions and why they're so good at it. So let's listen to AOC and then Katie Porter.
One of the things I particularly enjoyed watching you do is ask people questions on congressional panels. Now, this is not something you had experience with. You famously did not have any experience in politics before this job. Why do you think it is that you were good at it? And do you think anything you did that was outside of politics has been helpful?
Well, I think one thing is that I was just reflecting today because exactly a year ago, I was working in a restaurant. I was bartending. And I think that that proximity, just being a real working person in the halls of Congress, is actually such a jarring difference from who has historically been there, that it really allows you to cut through the BS super quickly. And especially as someone who had to, you know, close up a restaurant and at night and have to kick everyone out. Like, you're really good at just saying eight.
Yeah.
<It's> enough.
And here is Katie Porter.
Some of my colleagues in Congress, you know, they've been really flattering. They've said, you know, you're a great questioner. They're like, could you give me a tip? And I was like, well, first tip, ask a question. So, like, I've been listening to you for 4 minutes and 45 seconds, and you have yet to ask a question.
Yes, I've noticed that.
And then
that
the other thing is, like, I don't ask questions that I don't know the answer to.
Right.
So when I'm asking Wells Fargo, did you lie to the court or are you lying to Congress? I know the answer to that. They're lying to both of us.
Right.
So I know what answer I want to get out of them because I'm trying to share this information with the public.
So AOC and Katie Porter have both proved to be incredibly effective questioners in Congress, among the most effective. AOC's, in fact, we talked earlier about Michael Cohen. Her questioning of Michael Cohen, her specificity in getting him to admit that President Trump had likely committed insurance fraud or tax fraud, for example, she got new information out of him that you often don't see other more seasoned members of Congress get. Same with Katie Porter. She has taken her opportunities to grill. For example, we did a closer look on corporate profits and taxation and the fact that a lot of corporations were paying zero in income taxes. And on top of that, the fact that we're living in this gilded age of inequality, this massive level of inequality, and that Democrats like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and AOC and Katie Porter are increasingly starting to talk about that as a central message. And we played a portion of her grilling of Jamie Dimon in Congress, where she laid out a simple scenario of an employee working for Dimon who was in a very difficult financial situation because she's making very little, whereas Jamie Dimon makes $31 million a year, and just asked him about this basic inequality. And Dimon kept saying vague things like, you know, I'd love to see if I could help her somehow. And Katie Porter just asked a very simple question. Yeah. By paying her more, could you help her with your $31 million? And he would just be like, you know, he kept being very vague about it. And it was a very effective way of demonstrating the age of inequality that we live in. And here's the section of the closer look that we did on that.
You're acting like it's some unsolvable math problem instead of just paying her more money. Diamond's going to be up all night at a chalkboard trying to crack this one Goodwill Hunting style. Let's see. She has $2,000 and I have $31 million. Damn it, numbers, why won't you crunch?
Because it's true, there's like this phenomenon where billionaires and the moneyed elite, they talk about these problems, these social problems, as if they're like impossible to solve. Like Dimon was in that hearing and Katie Porter's asking very simple, straightforward questions, posing her specifics about how this person in her district
lives.
Human
level.
Yes.
Same with AOC.
And they act like, oh, you know, I just don't know, man. Like, what are we going to do about, you know, poverty or people not having health care and people going in? And it's like there are... Very, as we've seen, and this has been the refreshing thing about the Democratic campaign, about having people like Katie Porter and AOC in Congress, there are specific detailed plans for how to deal with these problems. And they've both been very effective at presenting them.
And it speaks to the power of the Democratic Party right now in that so many of the new members came from different life experiences and they can talk about issues at a different level and they can pose questions to really rich, really wealthy, really powerful people like Jamie Dimon from a different level and connect them to human struggles and to people that make them pop and make them relevant and make them understandable in a different way.
Which brings us, I think, to where we are right now, which is the impeachment investigation.
Yes.
And again, as you're listening to this, he may have already been impeached. The articles may have already been passed in the House. Yep. As we're recording this, they're currently marking them up in the House Judiciary Committee. But again, we've gotten to see members of Congress directly confront people around Trump, close to Trump, firsthand witnesses to the crimes in question. And we've gotten to see some very effective questioning. And there's a clip from A Closer Look I want to play where we essentially juxtaposed Adam Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, making a very powerful closing argument at the end of the Intelligence Committee's round of hearings about the summation of evidence that they had just heard. And compare and contrast that with one of Trump's rambling lunatic phone calls that he does, his like hour-long marathon phone calls that he has with Fox and Friends, where he comes and he just like rambles insanely. And then even they are kind of like stunned and dazed and don't know how to respond.
Anyone like talking to you for like an hour long phone call with anyone?
Yes, I know.
I would never talk to someone on the phone for an hour, let alone broadcasting it live.
Yes,
nationally.
No, yeah.
I don't talk to anyone for more than 20 minutes.
No, no, exactly. A phone call at all and be like, why are you calling me? Why didn't you text? Like, it's an emergency. If somebody calls you, it's like you think it's an emergency. But so here's
the family member calls you before 7:30, someone has died.
Yes, you're terrified.
It will never not feel like someone has died. Yeah.
So here's the section of the closer look we played on that.
But I really think contrast is worth noting and sums things up perfectly. On one hand, you have a calm, measured, fact-based defense of democracy and the rule of law. From one side, that whatever their faults as politicians inhabits our actual reality. On the other hand, you have a red-faced lunatic screaming at three terrified captives trapped on a TV set like they're in a Saw movie. I mean, look at them. It looked like three out-of-town tourists sitting on the subway who just saw a roach smoking a cigarette. And by the way, I'm pretty sure the roach was smoking the cigarette because he just heard Trump's interview.
This Trump guy's out of his goddamn mind.
Again, I love Seth's impression of the roach smoking
great
a cigarette.
Great roach impression.
Great roach impression. But yeah, there's a fundamental contrast that we've seen on display in these impeachment hearings, which is that we have, and this is just a very simple thing, but it's been repeated over and over again in these hearings. We have one side that occupies reality and yep. responds to facts and one that doesn't.
And with these moments, you do have to keep stepping back and look at the summation of evidence. And we talked to Kamala Harris about that near the end of October. She's a former prosecutor. And as we were saying with AOC and Katie Porter, a phenomenal questioner of witnesses. And Seth asked her about just the incredible amount of evidence that has been presented throughout the Trump administration, especially now with this Ukraine scandal.
You are a former prosecutor. Obviously, there, you know, it seems like the House is not going to vote on this impeachment inquiry officially this week. Are you, as a prosecutor, do you look at the evidence against Donald Trump, the impeachment evidence? Are there times that you say this is almost too much evidence? Do you think that... Well, because it does seem as though, and we don't officially know yet, there might be sort of a narrow focus in the House of let's just focus on Ukraine and what happened with that quid pro quo, as opposed to the fact that you could really kind of just pick any country and
China,
say, like, what are the illegal things that happened there? Do you think that's the right way to move forward? And do you think there is enough evidence for a quid pro quo with what we've seen and heard so far with Ukraine?
I do. It's extraordinary, to your point. We have a clear display of consciousness of guilt when they were attempting to then put the transcript in some secret computer. We have a cover-up that is that. And we have a confession. And as a former prosecutor, I know a confession when I see it. And the fact that Donald Trump does what he does in plain sight, maybe he thinks it should in some way, you know, absolve him. You know, I remember there was, I think it was Richard Pryor. Who was it who had a skit? And he would say, don't believe your lying eyes, right?
Oh, it was fantastic. I don't know, but I'm excited to Google it.
It was when he got caught cheating on his wife.
Oh, gotcha.
And he would say to his wife, don't believe your lying eyes, right? The American public, we know what we see. And frankly, somebody ought to tell Donald Trump he has a right to remain silent.
Now, let me ask you this.
Sick Kamala Burn at the end of that.
That is a great line, yeah.
But it is, we can see it with our own eyes, what is going on. And there was so much talk about the whistleblower and the whistleblower complaint, and then Trump just admitted it all on the White House lawn.
All of the Republican, he just went out on the lawn. They literally asked him, what were you hoping would happen in that phone call? And he said, well, I was hoping they would investigate the Bidens.
Yeah.
And then just for good measure, he threw in China, too. He was like, I also hope China investigates. But it is this bewildering thing where all of the evidence is in plain sight. The facts are uncontested. Republicans cannot contest the facts.
There's an admission.
There's a confession. They haven't even tried to contest the facts. They've just made disingenuous bad faith arguments about process and so forth. And it's all obviously a bad faith con. And to the point that Seth and Kamala made in that hearing, just to bring things full circle, because we began this with a summation of all of the evidence in the Russia probe. Here's a summation of all the evidence. We did these marathon closer looks throughout the impeachment hearings to close out the year. And this is a summation of just how overwhelming all of the evidence was in the impeachment process from a closer look.
Still, if you're a Republican, I get it. It's just so hard to say. Is Trump innocent or is he guilty? I mean, all we have so far is a sixth Trump associate convicted of a crime, two more indicted associates saying they were on a secret mission for him, his lawyer under criminal investigation, Trump himself committing witness tampering, the whistleblower's account claiming the president had clearly committed a criminal act, the notes from the call in which Trump mentions the Bidens multiple times, the part of the call where Trump tells the Ukrainian president, I would like you to do us a favor, the president's chief of staff literally confessing on national television, Rudy Giuliani going on TV and bragging about what he was doing, and like a bunch of witnesses saying, yes, there was a quid pro quo. I'm sorry, that's not enough to convict. Republicans won't budge unless we have a photo of Trump on the phone with a word bubble coming out of his mouth saying, I am doing a crime now.
So that kind of brings things full circle.
A year of crime.
Yes, a year of serial crime from the president of the United States.
And yet, we're looking towards a very close 2020 election.
Yes.
1 year from now, we will be doing this year in review again, and we will know who won the election.
Wow.
And despite all of the evidence of crime from our current president, there is a very good chance we will be sitting here talking about the second term of the Trump administration.
We have no idea what will happen, of course, but structural polarization makes it the case that really
about
no matter,
90% of Democrats might vote for the Democratic nominee, but 90% of Republicans will vote for Trump. This, again, just gets back to this main point of there's so much bewildering news every single day, and our bodies and our minds have just kind of adjusted to that level. And the new norm is just an overwhelming evidence of crime, as the show has laid out repeatedly for 12 months.
Exactly. And so it gets down to a very basic question of what kind of democracy do you want this to be?
A crime one?
Yes, a crime democracy.
Or a non-crime democracy.
Yes, or a non-crime democracy. And, you know, thankfully, as we saw in the 2018 midterms, as we discussed in the last year's recap, there was an incredible outburst of grassroots energy pushing back on the demagoguery of this president. And so we'll see how that translates into next year.
Yeah. Thank you so much for listening this year.
And we'll keep you updated on the kind of jello they're eating in the Senate.
Yeah, we're going to have Michael Bennett back when he is the nominee to talk about what type of jello the nominee gets.
Yeah.
We're looking forward to it. And thank you again, and happy holidays.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night Podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.